It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in a few minutes on Central Time, it's Food Friday. And in the spirit of the season, we'll figure out what goes into figgy pudding.
First, President Obama leaves to celebrate the holidays in Hawaii this evening, bidding farewell to Washington for 2013.
It was a rough year for the president with Edward Snowden's NSA leaks, a troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act website, and lower popularity with the American public.
Before leaving town, President Obama addressed the press and the public one final time this year. Here with us to talk about that final press conference is UW-Stevens Point political science professor Ed Miller. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Veronica.
Well, President Obama opened his address talking about the economy. What message was he trying to sell?
Right. He's trying to sell, obviously, the economy is getting better. We've come out of a recession some time ago, but it was a very slow increase. But now we're adding, he mentioned, 2 million jobs recently and 8 million over the last 45 months. Also, yesterday they had announced that the economy in the last month has grown by 4.1%, which is a significant growth in comparison to the previous time. So he started by emphasizing how much the economy is improving.
And that's obviously a decent place for him to start, given the fact that it has been, you know, it's been a rocky year for the president. He's had a few rough patches. What was the tenor of this press conference like in general?
Well, I think the tenor was essentially the president was very positive. Unlike his previous press conference, where he was more apologetic in terms of the Affordable Care Act's website and problems of enrolling people, this one he was much more positive on a whole range of issues, whether it's certainly the economy, the Affordable Care Act itself, in terms of who it affects and benefited already, as well as things that the administration is doing. And he emphasized that because that tends not to be seen, that they look at his legislative achievement, you know, president being the chief legislator and having difficulties, especially with the split Congress, but that the administration is doing all kinds of things itself by executive orders, by creating programs. He mentioned particularly the manufacturing hub, the Connect, which is the capacity, the wireless capacity in all classrooms in the United States. And they're also doing some things actually related to gun control, but by executive order. Now, I know that he didn't mention it, nor did the press mention it, that some of those are being challenged on whether the president can do that himself.
Now, in terms of bipartisanship, the president didn't exactly say, well, those days of partisan gridlock are in the past. Moving forward, we're all one big happy family. Did he seem, though, optimistic that there was the possibility of more cooperation down the road?
Right. I mean, he was more optimistic, although he was cautious. The optimism he mentioned certainly came out of the budget, which he didn't get everything he wanted, as he mentioned, particularly the extension of unemployment. That there is a 2-year budget agreement. He also mentioned immigration, which he spent some time on in the press conference, and particularly at the beginning that nobody in the press seemed to ask him about. It's one of his big policies is immigration, which passed the Senate. And Boehner has promised him, he said, that it will be brought up in the House. And he was very positive in passing that. He said he did not want to go back to gridlock. And some concern was expressed when one of the reporters asked about the extension of the debt ceiling. And he said, well, he's not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling because these are bills that have bills paying for expenditures that have already occurred.
Now, he also mentioned the launch of the Obamacare site as his biggest regret. I think I just heard in the NPR story that he actually used the term screwed up.
Right.
And I guess that's what we like to hear from our public officials, that when they screw up, they admit it, and then hopefully they can move on. Do you see that Obamacare rollout as being the driving force behind the public's low ratings of him recently?
I think so. I think that that was one of the major things. And then there was a continuing concern about the inability to sign up. Now, interesting enough, if you look at press reports, you don't hear too much about that anymore because now people are actually signing up. And so now the emphasis is on other matters with regard to the Affordable Care Act, such as the exemption yesterday, which really only applies to a very small number of people who've had their policies canceled and they don't have a new policy. They will be able to take only for 1 year a hardship out so they don't have to pay any fine if they don't have health care.
Do you get the sense that the tangled web that was the beginning of the Obamacare rollout, do you think that that is behind him and he's out of the woods now?
Well, I don't know if it's behind him. I think you're right. I mean, it depends how things go during the year. If during the year, and I expect it to occur, that there would be much more positive on the health care and a lot of these waivers that had taken place will disappear, you know, next year. And if they get the business small business website working, I think by next November, you know, the midterm election, things will be much more positive, certainly in the health care. I don't think everything will be gone. But he emphasized a very important point, and which doesn't seem to get a lot of play, is that really the website and this all signing up only applies to 15% of the population. 85% have health care and have received benefits, such as if you have, you know, deductions. Most people have deductibles, I should say, and copayments. If you get any preventative health care, you no longer have that. Or limits on yearly or lifetime health care, you know, how much you get. It used to be, you know, maybe $1 million limit on how much health care you can get for a lifetime. Those are all gone. So these are all, and I don't think a lot of people attributed that, and that was one of his points, to the Affordable Care Act.
Now, we've got to talk about another one of the black dogs nipping at President Obama's heels, and that would be the NSA surveillance issues that have come up. What did he say to try to put to bed some of people's fears about that?
Well, what he fundamentally said was that there has not been abuse, that, you know, there's concern. He wanted to balance, you know, privacy and abuse. He says there simply has not been abuse. And he says the concern is a perception that in lack of trust, essentially, of the people. And second, he said potential for abuse. Now, right so far, there hasn't been abuse. Therefore, is what he said was he will be looking very closely at these 46 recommendations that the committee reported to the president essentially on Sunday, but many of them were out last week, the 46 recommendations. The one he seemed to be going with, interestingly enough, was one that NSA said will be a problem, and that would allow the telephone companies to actually keep the data. And only if the data needs to be searched will they then seek it from the telephone companies. NSA seemed to push back against that because of technologically how to do it. And the other problem is whether the telephone companies right now don't keep the data for that long. And NSA was keeping it for 5 years, I believe. And but he seemed to be going for that one in this press conference. But he said he will get back about which ones he will approve, which ones essentially he won't, and which ones need work and maybe eventually approved.
Now, President Obama gave this press conference during the day. Was there any significance to that?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because, I mean, he's given most of his press conferences during the day, and given his dropping poll numbers, it would have been good, I mean, for him, to give it at night, in which he can emphasize this thing, you know, such as, you know, no abuses of the NSA, such as the 85% have been helped and how they've been helped. Those kinds of responses, you know, would have been advantageous to him if he spoke directly to the American people, because people would be watching it at night, much less so during the day. But he chose to do it just simply as a true press conference in the press room rather than in the more auspicious settings that we've seen before where the president walks down this hall and stands in front of the press is there. But it's really also speaking to the American people.
You think he was just eager to get to Hawaii?
No, because he could have done it before. He didn't have to do it today.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have done it another day. I don't think that was the issue.
Well, let me ask you one more question. He was asked outright, was this the worst year of your presidency? He didn't agree with that, but what do you think? Was it?
Well, he's had a lot of trouble this year. He did best in the first 2 years of his presidency, and that was because he had a Democratic Congress. This year certainly was a problem. The worst, it's a question of whether it was this year or when the question of shutdown of the government occurred. But I mean, this was in the beginning of this year or this year. But I mean, the Snowden situation has dogged him this year, and certainly the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. So, I mean, it probably was his worst year. He didn't look at it that way, he said.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. Have a nice holiday.
You too. Ed Miller joining us there, political science professor at UW Stevens Point.
Coming up, it's a Holiday Food Friday. We'll have figgy pudding and everything.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. The holidays are upon us, and many of us are still in search of the perfect holiday dessert.
Lori Skelton is a classical music host and a frequent contributor to Food Friday here on Central Time. Well, this week, Lori treated us to some homemade figgy pudding, and she's here to talk about what makes it a traditional Christmas favorite. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, especially when we're talking something that's chock full of fruit and more than a little bit of alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, can we start with that, actually? Because, I mean, the first time I told somebody that I had some figgy pudding, they made a really weird look with their face. I think people think about fruitcake.
Which is somewhat similar in certain versions of your traditional English figgy pudding or Christmas pudding. It's chock full of dried fruit, currants or candied citron or some. What makes a pudding different from fruitcake is that you steam it rather than bake it, which can actually be a real help when the holidays are busy. Because unlike something that you have to put in the oven and have to make certain that the oven is the proper temperature and you have to keep checking on it so it doesn't burn, you can steam a pudding longer than the recommended time and it's not going to hurt it. You can also make this well ahead of time. As a matter of fact, some of the traditions around Christmas pudding or figgy pudding say you make it even before Advent starts.
That's a long time.
And then you set it aside. And then
it becomes a doorstop.
No, actually it doesn't. Because what you do is you re-steam it for 45 minutes and it gets lovely and moist, but it's all ready made and you don't have to worry quite so much about steaming it to absolute perfection. You just get it warm, you get the moisture back into it. As we discovered a couple of days ago when we tried to flambé or ignite the pudding that
started
I brought
on
in
fire, right?
and because I had made it the night before but I hadn't had a chance to re-steam it here at work, it did not ignite as quickly. And so what you do, make your pudding well in advance, steam it right before you serve it, and then if you choose to douse it in brandy and set it on fire, it will look amazing as well as taste just that much better.
What I loved was the texture of it. I love steam puddings and I love how moist that they get when you do your steaming right and they don't turn into doorstops. But apparently there's some forgiveness there. But besides the steaming, what is it that makes a really delicious figgy pudding?
Well, for me, it's the figs. And what I do with the recipe that I've really fallen in love with, the recipe that Dory Greenspan created for All Things Considered, is that you take your dried figs and give them a gentle boil in water even before you add any brandy or rum. So the figs sit there and they get plump to begin with, and then you introduce the spirits and let them sit and talk to one another. So figs for me really do make a good figgy pudding. Although there are other fruits. My version has raisins and cranberries and dried cherries, a nod to Wisconsin. But I've been doing some research, though, online, and there's lovely variations on the idea of a steam pudding using orange or persimmon pulp, which is something that some people like to have on their tables during the winter. For something like that, when it's not quite so chock full of dried fruit, you probably don't even need to do the additional spirits or wine or anything.
So here's something that puzzles me. It's called pudding, but when I think of pudding, I think like snack pack or,
right,
you know, like Jell-O pudding. You know, why is it called pudding and why is the stuff that we normally think of as pudding not that?
Well, this goes all
because it's like a bread, right?
It is actually thickened with breadcrumbs, and it goes back. The first use of the word pudding in the English language goes back to about 1300. Back then, that would be beef or mutton that would be boiled in a skin. And there's some thought as to, is it pudding or is it the French word for sausage, boudin? There's also a dialect of Old English where pud means the belly, something round containing food. So as we move forward, around the 14th century, boiling beef and mutton with fruit and spices and wine became known as pudding. And that was generally served before Christmas. It's kind of like a porridge. But as you added more fruit and sweeter spices and eggs and got it thicker, that's where we get the pudding. Most people in Britain refer to any dessert as pudding.
Any dessert? Any dessert is Coke.
It's what's for pud is when you ask
for
dessert.
Huh.
And this is an English dessert, right?
This is very much an English dessert.
Do a lot of Americans eat this dessert? There is something, when I tasted it, I wasn't there right after you flambéed it or whatever you did. Which, by the way, we have the video up on Facebook and Twitter of the flaming figgy pudding.
Flaming pudding, yeah.
Who wouldn't want to see that?
Yeah.
But I had, it was still delicious, and it was lovely, but I thought, you know, it tasted like an English Christmas would taste in a food. Do Americans, have we embraced it the same way the English have?
Probably not the way the English have. I read somewhere that over half of the households in Britain will have a pudding at some point between now and New Year's. So I don't think it's as popular as it is in England. I'm hoping that maybe we might inspire a few people to try it, because I really do think it's worth it. The recipe that I use, you can bake in just your standard bundt pan, or not even bake, steam it. So it's not like you even need any special, all you need is one big pot to steam it in and one decent sized pan.
Another thing about it is, like, you know, talk about, you know, sort of British desserts and stuff, and it seems like it would be something that would be really hard to make, but it really isn't.
Actually, I think this is easier than fruitcake. Most of your steam pudding recipes have you melting the butter, and instead of creaming a lot of ingredients together and then adding things in stages, a lot of your steam puddings just come together in one bowl. I actually think it's, once you get the basic technique down, it's pretty easy to throw one of these babies together.
So how do you steam it? That seems like the mysterious part. We're used to steaming broccoli and things like that. What do you need to get it done?
You do need a big pot to hold all that water. I believe it was first mentioned to me in Dickens that Mrs. Cratchit did it in her washing copper, the big pot she had to boil water to wash her clothes in. I use an old roasting pan that I can put on top of my stove, put the bundt pan in, sealed up well with aluminum foil. You fill that with water, and you probably want to put a small rack on the bottom of the pan. You don't want that pan sitting right on top of your burners. So give it a little bit of space for the water to be all the way around it. Put some more foil on top of the whole pan, put the cover on, and let it talk to itself for about two and a half, sometimes 3 hours. Again, you can walk away from this, do other things, and not worry that you're going to ruin dessert.
And it's and it smells good, too, right?
It smells amazing.
So it's like edible potpourri, right?
Does that sound good? Yeah. I don't know, Mike.
Well, maybe not. Yeah, that's true. And I think it's illegal in some states. But,
I used a fair amount of spice with this. But, of course, if you're a fan,
it makes your house smell like Christmas, right?
It smells amazing. And if you're a fan of gingerbread, you can even do a steamed gingerbread where you're throwing in grated ginger, you know, grated fresh ginger and candied ginger and the powdered ginger. If that doesn't smell
fantastic.
Like heaven.
Yeah, that sounds great.
There you go.
Now, you still didn't get to the reason why they call pudding pudding. I guess because it's a dessert. And that Bill Cosby probably had something to do with it too, right?
What we refer to as pudding is very much an American and a Northern European invention. What we would call pudding, actually, a lot of Britain...
They would call it custard.
And they would actually serve custard along with a steamed pudding.
No, so that's confusing.
Only if you really want to push it. If you know, think of it as putting squared, if you will. And we had our pudding here with ice cream, which is perfectly fine. Applesauce is another good thing to serve with it if you don't want quite as many calories. I happen to be a fan of a lovely warm custard, you know, just having your wedge of pudding swimming in dairy and eggs.
You can't go wrong with that. Lori, thank you so much for joining us. Sounds delicious.
It's a pleasure.
That's Lori Skelton. She's classical music host here at Wisconsin Public Radio and a frequent contributor to Food Friday. Thanks,
and,
Lori.
And don't forget that we not only have that video of the pudding en flambé up on our Facebook page, but we will be getting the recipe as well and posting that. So those are both going to be available. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk with a Madison area pastor who says the city is selling African American short.
And we'll find out why nuts aren't just a delicious snack, but a healthy one, too.
Plus, we'll examine the everlasting popularity of the classic Christmas story, A Christmas Carol.
That's Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll learn about a new advocacy group taking shape. It's co-chaired by former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson and aims to bring the unique needs of the Upper Midwest to the attention of our nation's leaders. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time. It's Friday. Yeah. On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, we'll take a closer look at the severe weather passing through the state as holiday travelers gear up to hit the road, plus a behind-the-scenes peek at the job of a snowplow driver.
But first, former Governor Tommy Thompson announced last week he's teaming up with another former governor to build a bipartisan lobby for the Midwest region.
It's called the Midwest Council, and it aims to do a better job of bringing concerns of the Upper Midwest to the attention of lawmakers in the nation's capital.
Richard Longworth joins us now. He's a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Mike, good afternoon. Glad to be with you.
I'm guessing that the whole idea of the Midwest Council sounds like a good one to you.
It depends what it does. The idea of getting the states together, trying to operate on some sort of regional basis. My feeling is that we lose a lot here in the Midwest because the states are always fighting each other. Wisconsin and Illinois being prime examples. We're always trying to steal businesses from each other. We really don't realize that what's good for one state in the Midwest is probably going to be good for the states that surround it. Governors have a terrible time dealing with this because they're elected to serve people within their states, and so they score points by fighting with the states next door.
I think you have made the case, though, that there are other parts of the country that are much better at negotiating this kind of thing. What's the difference between the Midwest and, say, New England or other places like that?
These places have been doing this for some time. New England has been doing it for nigh on to 90 years now, something called the New England Council. And it lobbies in Washington. What it really tries to do is to organize New England states, the cities, universities, businesses there, to work together across state lines to improve their society. The Southern Growth Policy Board, which is based down in Raleigh-Durham, has been going for about 50 years down there. Again, this is an organization of state governments that work together to try and cooperate across state lines. The Midwest has never had anything like this. We have the Midwest Governors Association, but it has never been able to operate in this sort of cooperative way. As I mentioned, governors have a terrible time doing this, but ex-governors can be very good value. You talk to ex-governors and they realize just how much time they wasted in office fighting with
really?
The state next door. So what you have here is Tommy Thompson and Ben Nelson from Nebraska, both former governors, who are leading this, and this is a pretty good idea because they know what's going on. I'd like to see them get involved with Chet Colver in Iowa, or Jim Edgar here in Illinois, or Mitch Daniels in Indiana, get more ex-governors involved.
So
better would be to get the state governments involved, but that doesn't seem to be on for now.
Why do you think that ex-governors are able to look in the rearview mirror and see those things better? Is it because they feel like they have to support their state? Is it that boosterism issue or what?
Yeah, sure. Governors just love to cut ribbons. And a factory that, say, opens in Rockford, Illinois, that may employ get most of its employees from Beloit and Janesville isn't going to result in any photo ops for Scott Walker. Or if the factory opens in Beloit and employs mostly people from Illinois, mm-hmm. Pat Quinn isn't going to be invited to the opening. It's a matter of taking credit for what happens on their watch, whereas ex-governors know that there's so much that they have to do with economic development, with environment, with all these other issues, that if we work together and build for the future, this is going to look good for future generations. It doesn't do an awful lot of good for the person who happens to be sitting in the State House right now.
Now again, though, one of the points I think you've made about the Midwest in your writing is that the Midwest is somehow less able to do this than other parts of the country. So maybe this isn't just governors. Could part of this be the fact that in the Midwest there are a number of, you know, sort of big city, you know, sort of like, for example, you live in Chicago. There's Chicago, there's the Twin Cities, there's St. Louis, there's Indianapolis, there's Cincinnati. Do cities play a role possibly in why the Midwest doesn't collaborate as much as some other places like New England, for example, where Boston might be the dominant city?
I think probably more to it is that the Midwest is kind of a fuzzy notion. If you ask somebody to define what the Midwest is, some people say it starts somewhere around the Mississippi River and goes through the Great Plains. Other people will say it's the Great Lakes region, that is our industrial states, Wisconsin, say, through Ohio. What the Midwest is kind of indefinite. Everybody knows what New England is. You can draw a line around it. Everybody knows what the South is because of its particular history. So they feel there's a Southern identity. There is not a Midwestern identity. Cities, of course, can do an awful lot more. Right now, we have this tri-state alliance going here in which we are trying to put together some sort of a common economic development policy between Milwaukee, Chicago, and Northern Indiana. And the cities that are involved there. This is just getting off the ground, but people are realizing the cities, at least those of us who exist next to each other, really do have to work together.
So you actually think that cities could be the key to moving these things forward then?
No.
No?
I'd like to say that, but I'm not quite sure it's true. Cities tend to dominate their states. Getting Chicago involved in one thing is one thing. Getting Illinois involved is something else. Getting Milwaukee involved is one thing, but getting Wisconsin involved is something else again. There is not always that much identification between these big cities and their states. Quite often the cities have more in common with each other than they do with the states around them. And as I gather it, what Thompson and Nelson have in mind for this Midwest Council is to try and work on a statewide basis, to work with companies that not only in the cities but around the states, to try and do something, I'm hoping, with universities and get them to working together. But right now, from what I can see, I'm not sure whether they plan to do more in just lobbying in Washington, which is a good idea, or whether they are going to actively do what the New England Council and the Southern Growth Policy Board have done, which is really try to promote regional cooperation back home, back here in the Midwest.
And I mean, you know quite a bit about this. I mean, as part of your book, I believe, you spend a lot of time on the ground in all sorts of different places looking at the issues and identifying the issues. And I mean, I think we laid out some of those, you know, sort of the governors not being willing to cooperate. But what are some other challenges that the Midwest has compared to other parts of the country beyond not being able to sort of work together?
One of the problems is that we have relied through almost all of our Midwestern history, really, going back 100, 150 years, on this basis of heavy industry. Wisconsin certainly as much as any other state, but the other Midwestern states too. And we've had our ups and downs, But we always thought, well, it's a little cyclical problem and things are going to come back. We are now realizing that those good old days when heavy industry was the locomotive that pulled the whole region behind it, that's gone forever. It's not going to come back, and it is hard to get used to. We're having to realize that we need new industries, and we're going to have to look regionally.
But isn't that partly true? Because I would say, you know, couldn't you say that, for example, the South, I mean, one of the things that's benefited the South is a lot of factories have moved there because of different labor laws and things like that.
But they started promoting this in the days just after World War II, when they didn't have all this heavy industry, when they weren't getting this sort of Sun Belt influx. They've really worked on that. The New England Council got started back in the 20s when they were losing a lot of their manufacturing industries. These were the ones that first got hit by factories going to the South, a lot of textile, leather working operations going down there. So a lot of this, what has happened in other regions, has been a response to economic adversity. And we're going through a ton of economic adversity right now, and from what I can see, what Nelson and Thompson have in mind is trying to bounce back and look for new industries, and more power to them.
We're talking with Richard Longworth about the New Midwest Council, a New Midwest advocacy group co-chaired by former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson.
And we'd like to know your thoughts on this. Do you think the Midwest can and should do a better job of advocating for itself in Washington? And what priorities should the Midwest Council set as it lobbies for the needs of the Midwest? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Richard Longworth about the Midwest Council, a new lobbying group hoping to better represent the upper Midwest in Washington, D.C.
What do you think of this idea? What specific Midwestern needs do you believe need to be represented in Washington? How do you think the region can work together, the Midwestern states could work together to better get things done? We'd like to hear what you have to say about this. You can join the conversation with Richard Longworth by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Why don't we go to the phones right away here and go to Christian in Milwaukee. Christian, thanks for joining us today. Christian, you there?
Yes, I am here. Thanks for taking my phone call. First of all, I do listen to the show. I appreciate the opportunity to participate. And my general view, I have family that's from this area, and I've invested in businesses all over the country and the world. And I think that, you know, a lot of people tend to focus on where the jobs have gone and why they're leaving. And they may point to China. They may point to the South. But I think a lot of folks are failing to recognize the general overall globalization of the global economy. And let me just give you some basic statistics that I think people are probably not aware of. This is far beyond the whole issue of China and other places where there may be less expensive labor. Given the technology deployment has occurred in really third and fourth world, if there is one, type countries, our research indicates that there are now going to be over 10 billion laborers coming on the market. They're making less than a dollar a day right now in the next 10 to 20 years.
Christian, that's an interesting point. And I think, Richard Longworth, you've written about the whole issue of globalism and how that affects the Midwest. Could you respond to that a little bit?
Globalization has hit this region really hard with the outsourcing of the jobs. Well, like I said, what we did for a living, which was heavy industry, basically assembly line stuff, that's just really been picked off. So what we need are new industries in bioscience, biotech, nanotechnology, the water, the Great Lakes. If we could get the 8 American states and 2 Canadian provinces, the border of the Great Lakes, to work together to create industries relating to fresh water, much the same way as the Water Council of Milwaukee has done. These are the new industries that we need. Will they take up the slack lost by the jobs that have already gone away? Nobody knows yet, but this is what we have to work on. One way of doing this is to get state governments working together. Another is especially to get our big research universities exactly like the University of Wisconsin, working together on these issues so they can create the research and create the products that are going to drive our economy in the future. I'd love to see this Midwest Council dealing with this, because your caller's absolutely right. Globalization has taken away what we did for a living, and we got to find a new job.
Yeah, we're talking about Midwestern states working together in relationship to the founding of the Midwest Council, which is a new lobbying group to better represent the upper Midwest in Washington, D.C. Richard Longworth is with us. He wrote a book called Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. We're going to go back to the phones to Jay in Madison. Jay, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Interesting topic. My question is there an opportunity for Midwestern states to get together and do a regional infrastructure bank to fund roads, trains, you know, bridges, and that sort of heavy-duty infrastructure?
Jay, that's an interesting question. Let's see what Richard Longworth has to say. Richard?
I think it's a great idea. We waste a lot of money now, money that most of these states don't have, with duplication. Yes, we could work together with infrastructure banks to create infrastructure. A prime example, and you mentioned it, would be trains, especially high-speed trains. The cities of the Midwest, Mike, which you mentioned earlier, are just far enough apart to be unhandy to really work together. A really good European or Japanese-style high-speed rail network here in the Midwest is what we need, but this is, by definition, an interstate regional project. You can't just have high-speed within Illinois or high-speed within Wisconsin. We have to link this region together, and that'd be a great place to start.
Are there examples from other parts of the country where that's happened?
In high-speed rail, not much, not in this country. We've gone very slowly on this. They're trying to do some in California. You do have the Acela corridor up from Washington up to Boston, and that gets a lot of ridership. But I think better examples are countries like Germany or Spain, where you have a lot of big cities that, again, are separated by some distance. These countries, of course, are smaller than the United States, but they are just about the same size as the Midwest, and their cities are about far enough have a similar distance between them. High-speed rail has really brought these countries together and brought their businesses together, and certainly, of course, in the case of Germany, very much stimulated the economy.
We're talking about how Midwestern states can work together better. You can join the conversation still at 800-642-1234. We're going to go to John in Appleton now. John, thanks for joining us today.
I would just add that we don't want to forget about dairy, and one of the major challenges in the Midwest is the pricing structure that the closer you are to Eau Claire, the less you get for your milk. So somebody in California is going to be getting incentivized to raise dairy herds when people in Wisconsin are disincented. So correcting those ancient pricing policies would be something very helpful.
Now, I don't know how that would be aided by working together. I mean, if dairy industry in Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan, say, work more closely together, would that have anything to do with that, or is this another problem?
John?
No, I think that if the Midwest states that are all basically punished by how close they are to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, would be able to take on the rest of the country and basically get rid of some of these obsolete laws.
Well, now, one thing we should be able to do, there's a lot of laws, a lot of action that we need in Washington. I've always been struck by the fact that there is no Midwest caucus in Washington. There's no Great Lakes caucus, and there's no Midwest caucus. All the senators and all the representatives in this region represent a region that has very common interests. I know the bipartisanship isn't exactly the flavor of the month right now, but these are people who represent a region, no matter what party they are, that need a lot of help working together in a Midwestern caucus on this issue and on others would do us a lot of good.
So why do you think that's the case?
Mike, we're Midwesterners. We're just ornery. You ever been through the consolidation of two country schools, two community schools out in a rural district?
We'll
get together and help our neighbor with barn raising. Short of that, we love to hate our neighbor. We love rivalry. We're independent. We're cussed. We're ornery. And this carries over. It's our nature, and it carries over into our politics, now into our economy, in an era where to be small is to get bulldozed. We really have to work together. If the Midwestern Council can do this, fine, but it is going to mean going against our Midwestern grain.
Well, and I mean, I think that's a good point to make, because I think if you did aggregate all of the resources of the Midwest, it would be much larger than these other regions that seem to be doing a better job, right?
Look at our universities. We have more intellectual firepower in this region than almost anywhere else in the world, including the Ivy League. Put it all together and, you know, we would be unbeatable. But the problem is we don't put it together. Our great universities, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, compete as fiercely for faculty and grants and students and donors as our teams do on a Saturday afternoon. And this just doesn't make any sense. We are really all in this together, and the problems of this region don't stop at the Wisconsin border, and they don't stop at the Illinois border.
Let's pull in one more caller before we wrap things up. Kurt from Beloit, thanks for joining us. It's possible you may sort of reinforce what was just said, but I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say too, Kurt.
Yes, that is what I was going to reinforce. I wondered, I was thinking about the model of a kind of distributed network where all the way from Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, down to Indiana University, and combine that with what Silicon Valley did, where you would have even across the street, like what the UIUC, if you just had across the street a company of five or six folks who were working on some of the technologies, the nanotechnologies, biotechnologies, global technologies, the professor was talking about. But one thing that is missing there is a kind of infrastructure, a digital infrastructure, to connect all of those companies so that we really don't need things like high-speed rail.
Good point, Kurt. Thanks for your call. Richard Longworth, you have a quick response to that?
People getting together is still a good idea, but yes, you need the digital capacity. You need the broadband throughout these states to bring them all into this era. You can do this between states. I'd say you could do it between regions. Your caller is from Beloit. You had the Rock River Valley there, where you have Beloit and Janesville got their problems. Rockford down in Illinois has got problems. I think there's some people there who are trying to work together, but this means working across state lines. If this organization and the people in the Rock River Valley there can promote this kind of regional cooperation across state lines, it's to the benefit of them all.
Now, you mentioned in some of the more successful examples, the New England Council and in the South as well, that a lot of the creation of these connections were created because of a crisis. Do you feel like there's enough crisis in the Midwest right now to create the makings for more collaboration?
Well, Mike, I'm a big Chicago Cubs fan, so I am very comfortable with the concept of a bad century. And let's face it, our Midwest is now 40 to 50 years in the middle of a bad century, and we're not pulling out of it. The South went through a bad century between the Civil War and the post-war years, and it took some concerted action for them to pull out of it. That's what we face now, and until we get our act together the way they did, our own bad century is going to keep going on.
Well, Richard Longworth, thanks so much for joining us. Richard is a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Thanks again for joining us.
Coming up after the news, an update on the severe weather passing through Wisconsin and a behind-the-scenes look at the job of a snowplow driver. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.